Hundreds of cases of a mysterious lung illness seem to be linked to vaping, but some experts warn that severe regulations of the e-cigarette industry could backfire.
What we really have is a problem of vaping marijuana, not vaping nicotine. And that seems to be the most important thing that is being lost here in the conversation.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for September 5th, we examine the public health concerns about vaping nicotine and marijuana. Also on the show, ongoing protests in Hong Kong are also sparking demonstrations in the United States.
There are a lot of Chinese American students who are invested in this issue as well. They've visited China or they've visited Hong Kong. They have relatives there. So they all have a stake in the future of these areas.
And ahead of today's U.S. Open semifinals, we look at how Venus and Serena Williams paved the way for a new generation of black tennis players.
What we're seeing now with them still being in the game, but also opening doors for people like Naomi and Coco and Taylor Townsend and Sloane Stephens is really a testament to both their longevity and their tenacity.
All right, everybody, let's get going. In the past several months, the United States has seen a rise in mysterious respiratory illnesses. The patients, most of them teens or young adults, report symptoms like coughing, shortness of breath, and chest pain. And in some cases, they've wound up hospitalized on oxygen support. At least two people have died. Since late June, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported more than 200 cases of severe lung disease across the country. And there's at least one thing that most of these cases have in common. The patients reported vaping marijuana. Meanwhile, government regulations have mainly focused on preventing access to nicotine products. Earlier this summer, San Francisco officials approved a ban of nearly all e-cigarette sales in their city. And this week, Michigan became the first state to ban the sale of flavored e-cigarettes.
It is a public health crisis that we're confronting. Kids are inhaling an addictive substance, nicotine. They are inhaling it with a chemical, cocktail, including things like formaldehyde.
That was Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Today on The Takeaway, what we actually know and what we don't know about the impacts of vaping on the body. Michael Siegel is a physician and public health researcher at Boston University School of Public Health. And Sarah Overmall is a drug and tobacco policy reporter at Politico. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Michael, let's start with you. We just outlined some of the incidents that we've heard about with this mysterious lung disease. What do we know, at least from your perspective as a physician, about the link between vaping and these lung diseases?
Well, we know for sure that all of these diseases are related to vaping in some way. But the other thing that's important that we know that I don't think a lot of people realize is that most of these cases are related specifically to the vaping of marijuana, not nicotine-containing e-liquids, which are traditionally used when we talk about e-cigarettes. This is what most people think of. What's happening here is that most of these cases are linked to young people using illicit marijuana that they're buying off the street. And basically, it comes in the format of THC oils that have solvents in them and are incredibly dangerous because of the contaminants that can get in there. They're not regulated products. They're not tested. And so that's what the problem is. What we really have is a problem of vaping marijuana, not vaping nicotine. And that seems to be the most important thing that is being lost here in the conversation.
So, Michael, what is it about the vaping of marijuana itself that's causing these lung diseases so far? At least we know that there's a tenuous link to that. And why is it that you're not seeing the same incidences with nicotine products, for example?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. But I think the main reason is that the marijuana products that youth are using are purchased off the street, literally, essentially from drug dealers, and they're not regulated, and we have no idea what's in them. These are basically products that are made by illicit manufacturers without any regulations, without any testing. There's a large number of possibilities for what's causing it. We don't know exactly because the testing of the e-liquids hasn't been completed yet. But there's one possibility is that could it be the solvents that are used. Often butane is used, and a lot of youth are using butane hash oil to get their THC for vaping. And butane is definitely a respiratory toxin. There's also pesticides in these products. that could cause respiratory disease. Unlike products from medical dispensaries, they're not tested for pesticides. And also the oil itself is toxic to the lung, and inhaling it can actually coat the lungs with oil and it essentially stop the lungs from working. And we know that in some of the cases, that's exactly what is happening. So the reason why e-cigarettes don't cause this, at least the nicotine-containing ones, is that they're all alcohol-based, and they're all made by retailers that have been, you know, manufacturing these products for years, and we haven't seen any problem with them.
Sarah, I want to bring you in here because we're hearing Michael explain sort of the difference here between the impact of vaping marijuana oil versus vaping nicotine-based e-cigarettes. And public health officials have connected, as Michael was suggesting, some of the products bought on the black market. We just know the most recent case, I think, is this one in Oregon, where it was said that the person who died used a THC vaping product purchased at one of their state's legal dispensaries. Sarah, what do you think that case is going to do in terms of more scrutiny on the recreational marijuana sale industry?
That case really does change the game because, like Michael was just saying, a lot of these have been bought off of the street, but this was supposed to be something that, because that person went to a dispensary, there was some level of assurance around its safety. And so I think it does really put scrutiny onto the recreational marijuana industry and a lot of these states that have had it for a while. Oregon is supposed to be one that is better regulated. But the problem is the federal government still hasn't recognized marijuana as a drug with any medical value. It's in the most restricted drug class still, along with heroin and LSD. So it's not as though the federal government can start putting out regulations about this now and saying, here's how to better regulate marijuana. Right now, the FDA's hands are tied. They can't even really say what type of THC products could be safe or not because they don't even really recognize it as a product that's legal at this moment.
I mean, the black market has always been an issue when it comes to marijuana. We're seeing more and more dispensaries opening up across the country because of the boom in marijuana products. Is this going to prompt state and federal officials to try and crack down more, not just on the legal marijuana sale market, but also on the black market?
I think that it will. And like Michael had said earlier, there are a lot of theories about hash oil being what is the irritant here, but also the fact that pesticides could be a factor in that. And there have been some seizures by state officials of THC oils or marijuana product that has this dangerous pesticide in it, but they can't monitor everything. A lot of farmers will sell bad product onto the black market because they know that it is spoiled in some way. So it is going to be very hard to regulate. It's going to be one thing that I think these states that have had recreational marijuana legalized for a few years now are going to have to deal with first. States like Oregon, Colorado, and California that are really at the forefront of this.
Michael, from your perspective, I mean, does this essentially let nicotine vaping products or e-cigarettes that are, as you mentioned, alcohol-based and that that have nicotine versus THC marijuana in them, does this essentially let those off the hook in terms of any health adverse side effects here?
Well, no, it doesn't let them off the hook. It's just that they don't appear to be causing this acute respiratory outbreak that we're seeing. There's still a concern with regular nicotine vaping products for the possibility of long-term consequences in terms of heart disease and lung disease. We know that these electronic cigarettes do cause at least acute irritation of the respiratory tract, and they do cause some acute damage to blood vessels. What we don't know is whether if somebody vapes for a long time, for many, many years or decades, if that acute injury would eventually add up to causing chronic heart or lung disease. And that's a difficult call because we're not really going to know that for quite some time. It takes 20, 30 years, even more, for those diseases to develop. And since vaping is only, or e-cigarettes have only been on the market for, you know, about 10 years, we're really not going to have that answer for quite some time.
Just this week, Michigan announced that it would ban the sale of flavored e-cigarettes, which is now the first state in the United States to do so. What do we know about their plan? And what was behind this decision to ban the sale of flavored e-cigarettes?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that Governor Whitmer used this recent rash of vaping illnesses as the impetus to do this ban. She did a 6-month ban, which she is allowed to do in Michigan state law. She can extend that for another 6 months when she gets to the end of it. If she wants it to be permanent, from what I understand, it would have to go through other avenues like a ballot vote or the state legislature. But I also do know that a few other states are considering similar moves. And again, using this example of vaping illnesses as an impetus and saying this is a public health emergency. Again, I think it goes to a larger frustration with teen vaping in general and the background that this is already happening in. Last year, for the first time in 2 decades, teen tobacco use went up, according to a CDC survey. And so that's kind of, to a lot of public health experts, they're seeing sort of this progress that's been steadily made over the years being erased.
Michael, as a physician, what's your assessment of the CDC advisory to people who vape? And also, when you look at what Michigan did this week in terms of banning, at least temporarily, the sale of flavored e-cigarettes, how do you see that rolling out?
Well, first of all, in terms of the CDC communication, as Sarah said, it was really vague. They came out and they basically told people, if you're worried about this, don't vape. They happened to mention that many of the cases involved THC, but they didn't actually make a very clear recommendation saying, look, you know, kids out there, do not vape marijuana, in very clear terms. And what we know from risk communication in public health emergencies is that messages that are vague are not actionable. People do not pay attention to them. You have to be specific in your message, and the more specific you are, the more likely it is that people are going to act on that. So I think the CDC just has not been clear enough in tying this to vaping marijuana. And because of that, unfortunately, I think kids are just not going to listen. They're not going to get the message. As far as the Michigan flavored e-cigarette ban is, I think it's a terrible policy. And the reason why I think it's a terrible policy is because from a public health perspective, it really makes no sense to ban electronic cigarettes, but to leave real cigarettes on the market. You know, cigarettes are still killing 400,000 people a year. It's still the leading cause of preventable death in the U.S. And there are over 2.5 million ex-smokers who are relying on vaping products to remain off of cigarettes. And so what this is going to do is actually drive many, many smokers in Michigan, or ex-smokers, to go back to smoking. Vapers in Michigan who are using flavored electronic cigarettes to stay off smoking, it's just going to be easier for them. They're not going to drive across the state border, you know, to get e-cigarettes. And they can't be even buy them online. So they're going to, many of them are going to go back to smoking. And that's going to be a disaster from a public health perspective.
Michael Siegel is a physician and public health researcher at the Boston University School of Public Health. And Sarah Overmall is a drug and tobacco policy reporter at Politico. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I used e-cigarettes for a year and a half to help quit smoking regular cigarettes. I was not very worried about the effects. My primary care physician agreed with me and said no matter how bad they are, they can't be as bad as a lit cigarette. Being able to go to a local shop was incredibly important when I did that because I was able to find flavors that I liked that were a good substitute and actually regulate my nicotine to where I started with like 9 milligrams and worked down till I was at 0 milligrams. And once I was at zero, then I just had to break the habit of the vaping pen.
Hi, this is Michelle from Boulder. I have not personally tried e-cigarettes, but my teenage son has, and he became addicted to the nicotine e-cigarettes, and it's been a long haul trying to get him off of them.
Hi, this is Ross from Buffalo. Yes, I do use an e-cigarette daily in replacement of cigarettes. I am concerned with the health impacts, especially because they are a relatively new product. There hasn't been any long-term testing and not really sure what the long-term impacts are going to be. I would eventually like to stop sometime, but that's easier said than done.
My name is Helen Intile, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I use a Juul daily. I stopped smoking cigarettes a year ago. I know that I feel 100% better without cigarettes, but I am concerned about health risks using Juul.
Hi, this is Linda from Vancouver, Washington. I've never used e-cigarettes, but I am concerned about people's potential health impacts. In particular, I have a family member who smokes them and has for a few years now, And I'm really concerned about his health, even though he actually works for a major tobacco company. But he says he's told it's safer than regular cigarettes. He can't be argued with because the company tells him all this information. And I'm a little worried about that.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. This is The Takeaway. On opening day of the U.S. Open this year, a statue of Althea Gibson was unveiled. She broke the color barrier in tennis as the first African-American player to compete in the U.S. National Women's Tennis Championship in 1950. And at that time, women were not even being paid to play tennis. Just this week, Serena Williams won her 100th singles victory at the Open in dominant fashion.
Yes,
for me, I have to be the greatest, whether it's against the second seed, the number one seed, or the number 80th player in the world. I have to show up or else I'm going to go home.
Serena has the record for the most Grand Slam titles, and she's one of the best athletes we've ever seen. Her older sister Venus exited in the second round, but her career is also amazing. 7 Grand Slam singles titles, 12th all-time. Between the sisters, they have 14 doubles titles, and they've never lost a Grand Slam doubles final. For the past 2 decades, the Williams sisters have made a space for themselves and for other women of color in a very white sport. And today they continue to dominate the field, even as they pave the way for others. Ahead of Serena's semifinal match tonight, we're looking at the legacy of the Williams sisters and their role in changing who gets to be a part of tennis at the highest level. Amira Rose Davis is with me for that. She's assistant professor of history at Penn State University and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Amira Rose, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So lots going on, lots of numbers there. Let's talk about just the past week and a half at the Open. There was a powerful moment between two black players on the court here in New York. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, certainly. So Naomi Osaka and Coco Gauff had a match on Arthur Ashe under the lights. And Coco Gauff is the sensational 15-year-old who's just been storming into tennis. She was the youngest to qualify for Wimbledon. And now she's here playing deep into the U.S. Open. And she's, of course, playing Naomi Osaka, who won the U.S. Open on this court last year. And after Naomi Osaka defeated Coco, she actually asked her to stay on the court with her and share in the post-game interview and the post-game moment. And it was a scene very reminiscent of last year at the U.S. Open where Naomi beat Serena Williams and there was lots of tears abound. And they kind of stood in solidarity on the court together. And it was very powerful, especially because Naomi said, you know, I want you to do this. I want you to leave with your head held high. And she took a moment in the interview to turn to Coco's parents and say, you know, I watched you train. And she said a line that really jumped out to me, which is that, you know, it's unreal how far we've both made it together. And I think that a lot of people heard in that utteration of what it means to have these black women in this sport. And she's really speaking about the sustainability of this mentorship, this friendship, these cycles of mentorship that have opened up space for people to be unapologetically black and in this lily white sport.
I mean, that's one of the biggest things that stood out to me was just the need for that solidarity in a sport that's historically been very white and also very privileged. Can you talk a little bit about how not just Coco and Naomi have had to navigate the sport, but also how the Williams sisters really broke a lot of these barriers here? We mentioned Althea Gibson at the top of the show, but the Williams sisters, I think, were such a fundamental part of not just breaking the color barrier, but really sustaining the power of black women in this sport.
Yes, certainly. And so, like, obviously, Althea Gibson is really fundamental to thinking about this and people like Zena Garrison. But what the Williams sisters offered was a 1-2 punch that sustained for so long. Obviously, we're seeing it now. And it's really important to understand that the reaction that Venus and Serena get now and the kind of accolades and the chummy interviews, this is something that they only have because they're still in the game and because they're dominant. Like, they've forced the tennis establishment to wrap around them. And if you go back to very early on in their careers, you see some of the stuff they were fighting against. You see, you know, the beads flying out of Venus's hair and the umpire calling that an interference. And you see the tears and frustration when she's like, that didn't interfere with anybody. And you see the players who crashed into them. You see the rumors that their dad was over controlling them, fixing their matches. You see the racist chants. And if you put that into perspective, it starts to begin to paint a picture of how much they had to claw and fight to maintain in the sport. And because they had each other, they were really able to do that in a way. And because of their skill, where they were just unapologetic and they weren't leaving, they weren't going anywhere. And they forced the tennis attachment to yield to them around that. So what we're seeing now with them, A, still being in the game, but also opening doors for people like Naomi and Coco and Taylor Townsend and Sloane Stephens, you know, is really a testament to both their longevity and their tenacity from a very early age.
Another narrative that's come up quite a bit in Serena Williams' career is her relationship between her and Maria Sharapova. It's sometimes described as a rivalry. My issue with that, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, Amira Rose, is that Serena has defeated Sharapova in 20 of 22 matches. Why is it that the sports narrative around them continues to be a rivalry when, in fact, that to me is pure dominance?
Right. Yeah. No, this is one of those rivalries that is very much media fueled. I think when it really early on came about was that they represented these kind of polar opposites of the sport. Sharapova conventionally, you know, she's white, she's blonde, and she's smaller. And I think that it was something that was really easy to kind of grab onto when presented, when trying to package the sport. And it sustained. And the, you know, narrative about it being a rivalry is still hanging on, even though on the court, it's not really any competition at all.
Let's talk about where Serena has gotten some competition. It's from her own sister, Venus. And I wonder the way that both of their careers have taken off. Serena's obviously gotten a lot more of the spotlight. Where is Venus in all of this? And has she been overshadowed by her sister?
When they broke onto the scene, half of those finals, they're playing each other. And she's, besides from her sister, she's the most active player with the most singles titles. Besides Sharapova and her sister, she's the only one who's appeared in finals at all four Grand Slams currently on the tournament. I think it's also really important to understand that while we're looking at Serena's comeback to the sport after having a very complicated pregnancy and delivery and the birth of her child, you know, Venus has been battling a chronic illness for many years, and she's come back from a very severe back injury, and everybody talks about Serena's age, and Venus is 2 years older. And so I think that both on the court, but also off the court, where Venus was very much a pioneer on a driving force for equal pay, particularly at Wimbledon, those things and the fact that Venus broke into the sport and then, you know, pulled her little sister along with her. And so that can kind of get overshadowed, but Venus is still playing and she's struggling a little bit with injury right now. But last year and the year before that, she had some really good matches. And I think that it's really important to put that in perspective and remember, I refer everybody to Ava DuVernay's wonderful documentary about Venus called Venus Verse. And it really gives you a sense of appreciation for Venus on her own.
Amira Rose Davis is assistant professor of history at Penn State University and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Amira, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
除了邀请海外专家, 我已委任两位新成员加入监警会.
On Wednesday, Hong Kong's chief executive Carrie Lam announced that her government would withdraw the highly controversial extradition bill that sparked months of massive protests. But the protests have not let up, and in fact, the movement has grown and broadened its demands. Across the world, protesters have also staged rallies in support of the movement in Hong Kong, with the streets of Chinatowns in New York and Berkeley, California, filled with chanting and signs. But increasingly, these protests are being met by supporters of Beijing who are staging counter-protests and defacing protest signs. These clashes represent a divide within Chinese communities throughout the United States and elsewhere around the world. Here to help us understand these dynamics is Elizabeth Kim, senior editor and reporter for Gothamist. Liz, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Give us the latest from Hong Kong. I mean, were you surprised at Lam's latest move?
I think I was a little bit surprised just because the way the coverage has been thus far, it's basically been thought that Beijing did not want to back down because if they back down to one request, what does that mean? So I think it was somewhat of a surprise. But at the same time, the movement has grown to such an extent that it's no longer about this one extradition bill. It's about broader political reforms. So most experts don't expect this one concession to quell the movement. But it will be interesting to see, though, what happens. Does it fracture the movement somewhat? Will there be fewer people? You know, there are multiple things going on at the same time. The school year has started. So a lot of the protesters who are young students are going back to university. What does that do to the movement? So I think there are some lingering questions about what will happen in these coming weeks. And the weekends are basically when there's been the most activity. So starting this weekend, I think that a lot of people are going to be watching what's going on the ground in Hong Kong.
Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned the protesters are no longer just focused on the withdrawal of this extradition bill. What do we know about how their demands have shifted?
Well, they have a list of demands, and they include political reforms. They want certain changes to the elections. They want to be able to vote directly for certain elected officials. And they've also asked for amnesty for those that have been arrested during this 3-month-long protest.
Liz, this is also playing out in the United States. And to sort of take us there, The Takeaway spoke with Anna Young Chung, who's a professor at Manhattanville College and also an organizer with New York for Hong Kong. Here's what she had to say.
We are still urging for the rest of the 4 requests, and we are not going to back down until we achieve that. So this is overall, we received the message from Hong Kong and also our agreement with it, with the different cities. We still supporting Hong Kong 100% and to request for the rest of the 4 requests.
Tell us a little bit about what Anna's talking about there, because she's here in New York, and this is part of your bigger story, which is really looking at what's happening across the world in terms of Chinese communities that are reacting to what's happening in Hong Kong.
Right. This is an issue that's really ignited Chinese who live all over the world. Basically, they're all watching this, and it really exposes this political rift in the Chinese community, which is very broad. So it's not a surprise that in New York, that in places like San Francisco, in Sydney, in Paris, just anywhere where there are Chinese communities, especially young Chinese students who are very politicized, invested in the future and the direction of not just Hong Kong, but China as a whole.
Liz, let's dig into this a little bit more. I mean, tell us about what the demographic makeup is for those protesting in the U.S. in support of the Hong Kong movement. You mentioned there are folks in cities around the world, but are they mostly younger folks? Are they immigrant communities? Are they newly arrived? Because we know that the Asian American community as a whole is one of the fastest growing here in the United States.
Right. I think it's fair to say that a lot of activity has taken place on college campuses, so which suggests that it's a lot of them are students, and it's a mix of students who are coming from overseas, who are coming directly from China or Hong Kong, and there are a lot of Chinese American students who are invested in this issue as well, because this is something that they've talked about with their parents. They've visited China or they've visited Hong Kong. They have relatives there. So they all have a stake in the future of these areas.
What kind of protests or solidarity actions are you seeing across the country? Is it actual protests in the streets? Is it online organizing? Like, what are the ways that students are, and other folks are really trying to make their voices heard?
So basically, it's mirroring what's happening in Hong Kong, but on a much smaller scale, I would say. So in Hong Kong, you see a lot of activism that's being done through social media. You see a lot of rallies. There was a rally that drew 1.7 million people, which is what organizers were estimating. And you also see this phenomenon, which is called a Lenin Wall. So a Lenin Wall, for people who don't know what that is, it was a wall that originally began in the 1980s after the assassination of John Lennon here in New York, and it was built in Prague. But then what happened was spontaneously that wall turned into this site for pro-democracy expression among students in Prague. So since that time, this concept of a Lenin Wall has been borrowed by other groups, other pro-democracy groups, and most recently it was used in Hong Kong in 2014 when they had another pro-democracy uprising.
We also know, and you found in your reporting, that there have been counter-protests here in New York in opposition to the pro-Hong Kong protests. What does that look like, and how widespread are those?
So last month, there was a rally that was organized by pro-Hong Kong activists here in Chinatown, which was not a surprise because there is a very large community of expatriates from Hong Kong. And like I said, a lot of, you know, families who have been living in the U.S. for generations with connections back to Hong Kong. What was surprising was that on the same day, they saw a counter-protest directly opposite them, where there were many people holding Chinese flags, holding up signs that said things like One China, fake news. And then there was a little skirmish, you know, towards the end. Basically, that's kind of mirrored what's been happening in Hong Kong. And then the other incident that has been happening more frequently is with Lenin Walls, not only in New York, but in places like San Francisco. There have been vandalism of Lenin Walls. The Lenin Walls basically started out as just people putting up post-it notes, artwork in support of the activists in Hong Kong. Then what happened was they began being defaced or being destroyed. People started tearing down those post-it notes. And then in the worst-case scenarios, they started scrawling over them with their own graffiti or their own, some of it was profanity. So it's been this back and forth where counter-protesters will try to take down the wall, and then the pro-Hong Kong activists return and try to then revive the wall.
Elizabeth Kim is a senior editor and reporter with Gothamist. Liz, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
All right, everybody, that's it for us today. You can always find us on Facebook and leave us a comment there. And remember, you can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with anything you're thinking about. And there's a lot of people who make this show every day, and you should toast them and celebrate them with your heartiest wine. Deidre Debke is our executive producer. Our producers are Alexandra Boti, Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Rob Gunther, Jason Tureski, Meg Dalton, Andres O'Hara, Danny Lewis, and Jivika Varma. Our digital editor is Polly Irungu. Our engineer and board op is Vince Fairchild, and our director is Jay Cowett. David Gable is our assistant, and Lita Hollowell is our intern. Thanks so much for spending time with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.